This magic moment, so different and so new, was like any other.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Sweeter than wine. Today we're going to resume Volume 63, Number 1, which is the Fall 2023 issue produced by the North Carolina Museum of History. It is titled, It's Revolutionary, Prelude to War. And the first article we're going to read is Broadly Speaking by Sally Causey Bloom. The events of the American Revolution happened at a time when broadsides became extremely popular in England. Broadsides were large single sheets of paper printed on one side like a poster or a flyer. During colonial times, they were often posted on walls or print shop windows to share news, public announcements, political cartoons, or advertisements. In London, folks gathered daily at print shops to learn the news and view the newest cartoons. The cartoons made fun of the events of the time, but they also informed people how people saw these events. Political leaders easily recognized the power of a good broadside. American colonists also appreciated the appeal of political cartoons to inform public opinion. As you look at each cartoon here, think about these points. What is the viewpoint of the cartoon? Is it for or against independence, or a commentary on both? What is the event that inspired the drawing? How does it attract the viewer's attention? What message does the cartoon portray? And does knowing the date of publication help you understand the cartoon? Number one, 1766, the repeal or the funeral procession of Miss America stamp. Following the outpouring of protests, the new Prime Minister of England, the Marquess of Rockingham, was on the spot to convince Parliament to repeal the Stamp Act of 1765. The Prime Minister smartly hired artist Benjamin Wilson to create a cartoon to help sway public opinion against the act. The funeral shows the print shows a funeral procession of the Stamp Act with a child-sized coffin. The legislation had been in effect only 4 months. And it shows members of British politics following along. The former Prime Minister who passed the act carries the coffin. Number two, 1770, the Bloody Massacre. In Boston, people threatened and sometimes even harmed customs officials who collected taxes. In response, British soldiers were stationed in the city and lived in people's homes, the Quartering Act, which many resented. On that date, a crowd of people began insulting and throwing snowballs at soldiers. When they began throwing sticks and stones, other projectiles, the redcoats fired into the mob. 5 people were killed and 6 wounded. This print depicts the massacre, which became known as the Boston Massacre. It is not entirely accurate, but it worked to stir up strong anti-British sentiment throughout the colonies. 1774, the Bostonians paying the excise man, or tarring and feathering. Parliament's Tea Act allowed the British East India Company to sell tea more cheaply than colonial importers. In response, tea boycotts occurred across the colonies. Members of the Sons of Liberty destroyed 342 chests of tea to protest the law. In January 1774, after British customs officer John Malcolm mistreated a boy, Bostonians tarred and feathered Malcolm. This broadside shows Malcolm forcibly drinking tea while the hated Stamp Act is displayed upside down on a Liberty tree, with the Boston Tea Party occurring in the background. 1775, America in flames. Following the Boston Tea Party in 1773, Parliament moved to punish Massachusetts and reassert authority over the colonies. A series of acts that most colonists found intolerable was passed, which created greater furor in America. In this cartoon, America is represented as an older woman in the midst of flames of upheaval caused by the actions of Parliament, as led by Lord North, who became Prime Minister in 1770. Some of the images seek to put out the fire, but it is too late to stop what will become a revolution. The next article is Tear It Down, The Road to the American Revolution by David L. Fountain, who is professor of history and director of the public history program at Meredith College. On July 9, 1776, Continental soldiers stationed in New York City heard the Declaration of Independence for the first time as it was read to them in camp. Within a few hours, a nearby statue of King George III was ripped from its pedestal at Bowling Green, a historic public meeting place in Manhattan, where the horse-mounted monarch had stood. Members of the crowd cut the statue into pieces, scraped gold from its surface, and dragged various statue parts through the streets of New York. The American Revolution was well underway, and American patriots were eager to humiliate the British king they accused of tyranny. But why was there a statue of King George III standing in New York? The New York General Assembly had erected the statue just 6 years earlier in gratitude to the innumerable and singular benefits received from our most gracious sovereign since the commencement of his auspicious reign. In other words, the statue was an elaborate, expensive, and public expression of New Yorkers' affection for the British king. New Yorkers were not alone in their show of support for British leadership in the years preceding the American Revolution. In 1771, North Carolina militia, under the command of British-appointed Governor William Tryon, marched west to suppress the Regulator movement. The Regulators were backcountry rebels who resented the political domination of the Piedmont by Eastern North Carolina leaders. They challenged noted patriots like William Hooper. Hooper was one of the three North Carolinians to later sign the Declaration of Independence, but in 1770, Regulators had dragged him through the streets of Hillsboro because they believed he and those of his rank and status threatened their liberty. The North Carolina General Assembly viewed the Regulators as such a threat that future Patriot leader Samuel Johnston of Edenton sponsored a riot act that empowered the colonial government to crack down on its critics and even impose the death penalty. When this did not end the Regulator threat, North Carolina militia faithfully followed the Crown-appointed Governor Tryon, took up arms, and defeated their fellow colonists at the Battle of Alamance on May 16, 1771. Yet, 4 years later, North Carolina Governor Josiah Martin, Tryon's replacement, fled the capital at New Bern for the safety of the HMS Cruiser, a British ship anchored off the coast, because he feared American revolutionaries on shore. What happened in colonies like New York and North Carolina that led Americans to abandon the British leadership they once celebrated and trusted? To understand this transformation, we need to look back to the British victory in the French and Indian War, which went from 1754 to 1763. When Britain and her American colonists defeated the French and their American Indian allies after 9 years of war, the British Empire stood jubilant but nearly broke. Multiple 18th century wars protecting and expanding the British Empire had been very costly. Britain now expected the maturing colonies to pull more of their own weight. Britain specifically wanted American colonists to help pay for the wars that successfully rid the colonists of their rival French, who menaced them both throughout the colonial era. To accomplish this, Britain passed a series of taxes beginning in 1765 with the Stamp Act, a tax on paper and printed materials, to help cover the cost of maintaining the British Empire. However, American colonists had grown accustomed to a large measure of self-rule, which included local taxation approved by colonial legislatures. The British Parliament had allowed this, but never abandoned the right to legislate and tax on behalf of the colonists. For colonists, this habit of approving all taxation became, in their minds, a right. Imagine, if you will, that throughout middle school, your parents allowed you to stay up late texting with friends as a reward for making good grades. Then when you get to high school, your parents worried that too much texting might hurt your studies. In order to prevent that, your parents made a rule that you have to turn off your cell phone by 7 p.m. and focus on homework. That means that after 7 p.m. you can't text until tomorrow morning. How would this change make you feel? Parents have a right to set boundaries for their children. They pay for the cell phone service. They have a responsibility to help you be successful. And they never said the reward of late-night texting would continue forever. They have a right to make that change. But I can imagine their decision would lead to a difficult conversation. This is similar to what the colonists experienced. Taxation is a legal way of requiring citizens to contribute some of their wealth, commonly called property in the colonies, to fund government and promote the public good. In Britain and the colonies, people needed to have property to be able to vote, a key aspect of political and personal liberty. For colonists, taxing Americans without colonial legislative approval was taking away a cherished right. If government can take property, tax, without permission, then colonists believed liberty was gone too. When Britain insisted that Parliament had a right to tax colonists without the approval of colonial legislatures, colonists believed their liberty was threatened, and old friends became new fiends. For North Carolinian Maurice Moore, taxation without representation stripped colonists of that constitutional right on which their liberty and property depends, which to colonists like him meant people were not free. This tension between liberty and property as the basis for true freedom would inspire, affect, or frustrate North Carolinians of many backgrounds, free, enslaved, patriot, loyalist, regulator, male, female, throughout the Revolution. Here are the captions of the photographs accompanying this article. Governor William Tryon's account of his expedition against the Regulators. And this image is believed to be Judge Maurice Moore, author of The Justice and Policy of Taxing the American Colonies, a pamphlet protesting the Stamp Act of 1765. The Sons of Freedom pulling down the statue of King George III with ropes as a crowd of men, women, and children watch. Bowling Green, City of New York, July 1776. An illustration of Royal Governor William Tryon confronting the Regulators alongside North Carolina militiamen. An engraving possibly produced by a Bollett Company titled Governor Tryon and the Regulators, circa 1877. Next, How to Pay for a War by Sally Causey Bloom, who was an educator at the North Carolina Museum of History. The Stamp Act. Why did England need more money? Paying for a war runs up the bill. The French and Indian War from 1754 to 1763, also known as the Seven Years' War, occurred between France and England and eventually Spain. Fought on three continents, it had far-reaching consequences. Soon after the war ended, the British Parliament passed the Stamp Act in March 1765 to help pay the costs incurred by England in the colonies for the war. The Stamp Act was a direct tax on the colonies, meaning the colonial governments had no say in its passage. Colonists were required to pay in British sterling, money hard to come by in the cash-strapped colonies, for stamps on papers, documents, and even playing cards. Did you say Indian War? Both the English and French sought American Indian allies to bolster their positions in the far-flung, long-lasting war. American Indians considered their own positions and weighed which allegiance would benefit their tribes. Many American Indians distrusted the English colonists who encroached upon their lands. Others distrusted how French traders claimed power in the lands of their ancestors. Wasn't this war about lands far away? What began as a struggle for control of the Ohio Valley in what is now Kentucky became part of a larger war. North Carolina got involved when Royal Lieutenant Governor Dunmore of Virginia needed help protecting its claim to lands in the Ohio Valley. The Provincial Assembly sent some 450 men under the command of James Innes. Innes's unit disbanded in 1754 without seeing any real action. When the assembly sent more men into service in 1755 under Major Edward Dobbs, backcountry residents asked for help closer to home. Settlers were attacked by American Indians on the frontier as settlers encroached on native lands, then the Piedmont. Some believe the French were encouraging the raids. Royal Governor Arthur Dobbs encouraged the provincial assembly to send them to the Piedmont. What kind of help? A fort and some soldiers. In 1755, Hugh Waddell sent a company of some 50 men to build a fort in the new county of Rowan. Fort Dobbs was the only major military installation between Virginia and South Carolina. It served as a storage facility, negotiation site, and a place of shelter for settlers fearing attacks. Separate from the ongoing war, settlers feared Cherokee reprisals as they encroached on Cherokee lands. Worried, many settlers moved into Fort Dobbs. In February 1760, Cherokee warriors attacked the fort. Waddell and 9 or 10 men left the fort and confronted about 60 Cherokee armed with tomahawks. Waddell's men fired their weapons and retreated. 12 Cherokee, 2 soldiers, and a settler child were killed. British forces prevailed in attacks on the Cherokee, and in 1761 the Cherokee sued for peace. The war ended? Finally, in 1763 the war ended, with the Treaty of Paris. England gained control of Canada and the lands between the Appalachian Mountains and the Mississippi River. With threats from the Cherokee, the French, and France's Indian allies removed, North Carolina settlers faced an expanded frontier. Colonists gained experience in fighting together toward a common cause, and that was helpful when England requested colonial assistance in paying war debt through new and increased taxes. Here are the captions for the photographs accompanying this article. A one-penny stamp act of 1765 proof. Malachiah G. Taylor, an enrolled member of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians, helps interpret the history of Fort Dobbs. Fort Dobbs, named for Royal Governor Arthur Dobbs, represented safety to colonists in North Carolina's 1760s frontier. The next article is The Prelude to War in Economic Context, Complicating the Story, by Peter A. Kaklanis, who is the Albert R. Newsom Distinguished Professor of History and Director of the Global Research Institute at UNC Chapel Hill. Today's world is full of crises. Seldom does a day pass without media coverage of some type of crisis in one place or another. History may not repeat itself, but according to Arthur Mark Twain, it often does rhyme. It is conventional to begin the story of the run-up to the American Revolution with a crisis, one arising from the response of many free white colonists to a series of policy moves by the British Parliament and the Crown beginning in the 1760s. Parliament is the legislature or lawmaking group in the government of United Kingdom, Great Britain, and the crown is the government of a country that is officially ruled by a king or a queen, or the position or power that a king or queen has. Some of the most famous episodes in American history and lore are associated with this crisis, the Boston Tea Party, for example. And a slogan used by protesters against British policies is still widely remembered today, "No taxation without representation." The problem is that often neither the policy moves by the British, nor the response by some colonists, nor the crisis that followed are placed in proper historical context. The policies that led to protests against the British in the late colonial period can legitimately be interpreted as efforts by the British government to impose more regulations and taxes on the colonists than the colonists were accustomed to. One can point to many examples of such efforts in the 1760s and 1770s, which are often bundled together by students and scholars alike as the Acts. Many readers are probably already familiar with at least some of these Acts, the most notable of which were the Proclamation of 1763, the Currency Act, and the Sugar Act a year later, the Stamp Act in 1765, the Declaratory Act of 1766, the Townsend Act, 1767, the Tea Act, 1773, and the 1774 Coercive Acts, better known in the colonies as the Intolerable Acts. From the perspective of many free white colonists, these policies and actions were illegitimate infringements on the traditional rights, freedoms, and privileges of British subjects. Subjects are people who live in the territory of, enjoy the protection of, and owe allegiance to a sovereign power or state. The policies and actions were considered particularly irritating because they were imposed after a period of roughly a half century in which British rule in the colonies was viewed as rather light and loose. The British Crown and Parliament might have agreed with the colonists that the conditions of rule were lighter and looser earlier in the 1700s, but they would argue that this was the case because circumstances were different earlier in the century. They would contend that the Crown and Parliament always had the authority to set the economic rules, laws and policies affecting trade, money, taxes, territorial expansion, etc., in the colonies. In the view of the Crown and Parliament, the policy changes in the 1760s came about not because the British were claiming new powers, but because circumstances had changed dramatically as the result of the Seven Years' War, also known as the French and Indian War, 1754 to 1763. Victory in this war was hardly cheap, however. When peace returned, the British government tried to recover some of its costs that it incurred defending the colonies during the war, either by levying new taxes through the Stamp Act and the Townsend Acts, for example, or by finding ways to raise more money through existing duties, such as the Sugar Act. To do this, the British increased the tax collection and enforcement personnel on the ground in America. During the same period, the British government, through the Proclamation of 1763, also tried to limit conflict with American Indians and military expenditures in the West by banning colonial populations from settling west of a designated line running through the Appalachian Mountains. To make sure that its new policies would stick, the British government pursued yet another set of controversial initiatives. It tried to curb the powers of the colonial legislatures in various ways. Taken together, these policies and actions can be read as attempts by the British both to tighten up administration of the American colonies, along with their expanded global empire, and to put colonial administration on a firmer financial footing. Spoiler alert. By the late colonial period, it was becoming clear that the colonists and the British Crown and Parliament saw many things quite differently, including the nature of the proper relationship between the colonies and Great Britain. History is full of ironies, contrasts between how things seem and how they actually are, and the Revolutionary Crisis is an example. It occurred despite, or perhaps because, of the fact that the colonies and most of the free colonists had flourished under British rule. The original idea to establish and support colonies in North America was based on the British government's assumption that the primary purpose of the colonies established was to increase the economic and political power of the mother country. The mother country is the country where the people of a colony come from. Regulations and laws were being put into place by the mid-1600s to try to ensure this would be the case through the navigation of the creation of the so-called navigation system. From the British point of view, it would be considered a plus, of course, if the colonies flourished as well, but the well-being of the mother country was first and foremost. Over the course of a century and a half, from 1607 to the 1760s, the free white population in the British colonies in North America, generally speaking, did indeed flourish. This group comprised about 80% of the non-American Indian population in the British colonies on the eve of the Revolution. Enslaved Africans and African Americans comprised the remaining 20%. The free population flourished because of a combination of factors: private property and the rule of law, a wealth of natural resources, significant international demand for crops, raw materials, and goods produced in the colonies, privileged access to excellent, relatively inexpensive manufactured goods produced in Great Britain, military protection by Great Britain, and alas, one other factor as well, the exploitation of enslaved Africans and African American laborers. The British government placed certain limits on colonial trade and on the types of economic activities the colonists could pursue. But these limits, historians have found, did not set back the colonial economy very much. Indeed, on the eve of the American Revolution, the free white population of British North America was as wealthy as the population of Great Britain, which at the time was considered the wealthiest of the world. Why then were many of the colonists so angry at the British in the 1760s and 1770s? For one thing, the economy was not the only issue of importance to them. Other issues were in play as well, particularly political and constitutional issues regarding the proper relationship between British subjects in the colonies and the Crown and Parliament. From the point of view of the disgruntled in the colonies, a more equal relationship was required, one that would give the free white population in the colonies, a wealthy and sophisticated people sharing the same culture as Britons, political and constitutional rights and freedoms similar to those populations living in Great Britain itself. The Crown and Parliament disagreed with this view, and crisis ensued. This crisis led ultimately to a successful revolution by the colonists against British rule, the many dimensions and vast consequences of which revolution were, of course, largely unforeseen. Here are the captions accompanying the photographs in this article. Patrick Henry delivering his great speech on the rights of the colonies before the Virginia Assembly convened in Richmond, March 23, 1775. His last sentence, "Give me liberty or give me death," became the war cry of the Revolution, published by Currier and Ives circa 1876. King George III in coronation robes circa 1765, painting by British artist Alan Ramsay, born 1713, died 1784. And the Boston Tea Party was a political protest that occurred on December 16, 1773 at Griffin's Wharf in Boston, Massachusetts. To protest taxation without representation, American colonists disguised themselves as American Indians. Then they dumped 342 chests of British tea into the harbor, an act that helped ignite a revolution. Here is a story from our collection, Portraits, circa 1750 to 1768. In the 1700s, only the very wealthy could afford a portrait of themselves. Even silhouettes, black cut paper that only showed the profile of a person, while less expensive, were relatively scarce. In the time before photographs, any representation of a loved one would have been rare and precious. If it took days, weeks, or months to travel to visit your friends and family, how valuable would even a small depiction of them be to you? Key, circa 1770s. Why is this a revolutionary artifact? It may not look like much, but this object held the key, wink wink, to making North Carolina first in freedom. Reportedly, it opened the door to the meeting in Halifax, where the door to the building in Halifax, where the 4th Provincial Congress approved the Halifax Resolves on April 12, 1776. That document instructed the colony's delegates to the Continental Congress in Philadelphia to vote for independence, making us the first colony to officially call for freedom from Great Britain. We've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Please listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long till next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.